From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Greece has been scary enough, now there's Italy. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Greece now has a unity government led by a banking technocrat pledged to avoid bankruptcy, however unpopular austerity measures might be. Italy has an economy almost triple the size of Greece, Portugal, and Ireland combined, with a massive debt it might not be able to pay. Its shaky economy is the creature of Prime Minister Berlusconi, one of the world's most colorful leaders. Will he really get out of the way? We'll get a taste of Italian politics today and hear what a national bankruptcy would mean for world markets and American banks. On Reporter's Notebook later on, can Rick Perry's campaign survive his latest gaffe? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Greece at least appears to be getting its economic act together, but Berlusconi's Italy is another matter. We heard about the billionaire prime minister who's promising to resign and what Italy's potential bankruptcy could mean for the rest of the world. On Reporter's Notebook, Texas Governor Rick Perry's engaged in damage control after his loss of memory during last night's Republican debate. Can he save his candidacy? First, this news update. After Penn State trustees fired legendary football coach Joe Paterno, thousands of students stormed downtown State College, Pennsylvania last night, chanting his name. The crowd had to be dispersed with tear gas. This morning, Paterno's replacement, former player and defensive coordinator Tom Bradley, spoke to reporters.
Tom, I know you've waited a long time to be a head coach. You couldn't imagine under these circumstances. Can you sum up your feelings?
Well, we're obviously in a very unprecedented situation that we find ourselves in. And, you know, I've got to find a way to restore the confidence and to start a healing process with everybody. And I'm going to try to go about it. It's, as I said earlier, it's with very mixed emotion and a heavy heart that this has occurred, that I'm going through this.
Michael Sansarino joins us again, sports reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Michael, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Did anybody ask the new coach why this had gone on as long as it had, whether other members of the staff might not have seen more than we've heard so far?
Yeah, that question was asked several times to Tom Bradley directly, and whether or not he knew of these allegations. And at several times he said that he would not answer those questions on advice of counsel. He did say that he did not know the allegations in 1999 when he took over for Jerry Sandusky as defensive coordinator. He also said that he did not know in 2002 when the graduate assistant allegedly found Mr. Sandusky in the shower with a young boy. But otherwise, when asked if he knew of the allegations eventually, what his role was, what he said to the grand jury when he met before them, he was noncommittal and would not give answers to that.
And Sandusky, of course, is the man who faces charges of child abuse after the incidents, at least two of the many incidents, two of which you just elucidated. You're back in State College today. What's the mood this morning?
Well, the mood this morning is still a little confusion. Last night was quite a scene in downtown State College where students took to the streets. They knocked over lampposts. They overturned a news van and had to be dispersed with tear gas and pepper spray. This morning, I think there's a little more clarity because Tom Bradley has spoken. He's sort of taken the reins of the program, and students on a whole have a bit of a clearer head. The head of the student government addressed students today at the Old Main Building. And even Joe Paterno spoke last night outside of his house, asking for students. He actually told them to go study, but he asked them to respect student or university property and to be respectful of what the Penn State name means to them. And up until, you know, a week ago, it meant doing things with honor. And now I think a lot of students are trying to figure out what that name means.
Has Mr. Paterno, has the head of the student government, has anybody else talked about the victims?
Mr. Paterno did. Joe Paterno did last night. He every time he comes out and talks to the students, he asks them to pray for the victims. Last night during the demonstration, there were students out there who were critical of Joe Paterno. There was one who held up a poster that said, Paterno is not the victim. There was another student who sat in the middle of the thousands, silently praying over a single lit candle for the victim. So you have people who are keeping the students in mind, and actually during Saturday's game, students are trying to organize a blue out where they will wear blue shirts in honor of child abuse victims, as opposed to the white out, which typically happens at Beaver Stadium.
But the main concern appears to be the fate of this legendary coach. What does that suggest about the culture of Penn State and the town, State College?
Well, it suggests that this is a football-crazy town, and it always has been, and Joe Paterno has been synonymous with this university. I think it's also interesting that you also had the university president dismissed last night. And at many schools, when the university president is fired, that's the biggest news. Here it's Joe Paterno. He has trumped this horrendous child abuse scandal in terms of the news cycle and in terms of what students are talking about. And he has trumped the ouster of the university president. I have a feeling, though, that as time passes, the attention will turn back to the victims and the child abuse, because it is just such a difficult story to grasp. And it's one that is truly sickening to certain levels.
And obviously it shocked a lot of people, including the students, many of whom I guess came there because they wanted to watch those football games.
Absolutely. And the irony here is that Penn State football was always known as a program that did things the right way. They had not been ever found guilty of any NCAA violations, which they're one of two major Division I programs to have claimed to that. They have these words that display on their stadium, say, success with honor, on the big LED screen. And I think that's what's such a shock now, is that they came to this school, they love this program that had done things the right way, supposedly. They love this coach who had said all the right things and lives in a modest house and donates a lot of money back to the university.
Okay.
The world has turned over.
Michael Sansarino, sports reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Many thanks to you. In a moment, Greece has been scary enough. Now there's Italy on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. When it comes to the troubled economies of the Eurozone, contagion is what economists, bankers, traders, and political leaders fear most. Now the focus has shifted from Greece to Italy. Rachel Donadio is Rome Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She has also covered the ongoing saga in Athens. And Rachel Donadio, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we get to Berlusconi's Italy, let's talk a bit about what's happening in Greece. Update us, if you will, on the aftermath of the resignation of the Prime Minister, Mr. Papandreou.
Well, what happened today is that Lucas Papadimos, a well-respected economist and a former governor of the European, former vice president of the European Central Bank, was named to replace Papandreou as prime minister. He'll guide a national unity government that brings together people from across the political spectrum. His mandate is to keep Greece in the Eurozone. It is a difficult mandate, but he's seen as the best hand to guide the country in a difficult time when a lot of the established political forces have been reluctant to push through reforms, in part because they don't want to take the political cost.
There has been rioting in the streets of Greece over some of those political reforms, though. Is that the only way to keep Greece in the Eurozone?
By having a technocratic leadership, you mean?
No, by having reforms that are so unpopular that people rush into the streets.
Well, you know, I think it's a big question whether Greece can stay in the Eurozone no matter what they do. But the issue is that they spend more than they take in. And unless they can do reforms to the labor market and cut back their public sector, which costs too much, then they won't be able to stay in the Eurozone. It's a very difficult situation for Greece. In Italy, the situation is also dire, but for different reasons. Now, yesterday, bond markets hammered Italy after contagion from Greece, meaning that people were selling off lots of Italian bonds. Yields on bonds went to 7.4% for Italy, which is extremely high. It's an unsustainable level. They can't pay that amount of interest for too long, or their liquidity crisis will turn into a solvency one. What we're seeing in Italy is something we never thought would come about, which is the end of the Berlusconi era. In the end, it was not any internal Italian political logic, but the force of the markets that seems to be pushing Berlusconi out of office. That's going to happen in the coming days.
To what extent did this man, 75-year-old billionaire, one of the world's 200 or so richest people, to what extent are the problems, economic problems in Italy, the result of his administration?
Well, Italy has long-standing structural problems. It does not grow. It has a ton of red tape. It has too much bureaucracy. It has very high taxes. It has protectionist guilds that make it difficult to do anything. Those are problems that Berlusconi inherited, but they're problems that he didn't solve, even though he was elected three times on a reform platform. So ultimately, in the 17 years in which he dominated Italian politics, and certainly in the last decade since 2001, Italy on his watch has dropped in rankings of competitiveness, transparency, all kinds of economic indicators. So he leaves Italy a weaker country than the one he founded.
He has said that he will resign on Monday. Does everybody believe that?
He has said that he will resign after Parliament approves some austerity measures that it needs to pass. Those will be passed on tomorrow in the Senate and on Saturday in the lower house. And so by Monday, maybe even sooner, he will resign. No one believed him at first. They felt like most Italians said, yeah, right, you know, I believe it when I see it. And the skepticism was so great that yesterday the president of Italy, Giorgio Napolitano, issued a statement saying, yes, the prime minister will resign. He gave me his word. He has to do that. I mean, I think that one of the interesting things about this crisis is that the president of Italy has been kind of helping navigate this very delicate political transition, which is not only Italy hit by the debt crisis, but the end of the Berlusconi era.
Will the measures that are going to be passed, presumably, deal with the issues you mentioned, the red tape, the high taxes, the guilds that are unmovable, and the fact that Italy's not growing?
Well, they're supposed to address some of those issues. They're supposed to liberalize some of the closed professions. They're supposed to sell off some state assets, including farmland. They're supposed to make it easier to transfer public sector workers as a precursor to possibly laying them off. But they won't address some fundamental issues like labor reform, which is still really seen as a third rail in Italian politics, nor will they address some pension reform issues. But the idea, according to the experts that I've been talking to, is that they'll pass these measures. They're not hugely great measures, but they're something. And then Berlusconi steps down, and then we get a new government led by Mario Monti, a former European commissioner, who's seen as a well-respected technocrat. And on his watch, the expectation is that Italy will be able to push through other reforms. There is a precedent for this. In the 1990s, Italy had different technocratic governments that were able to reform its pension system and also make significant changes that were required to get Italy into the euro in the first place. So I don't think all is lost for Italy. I think the bond markets have been hammering it, but its economic fundamentals are really not as bad as they seem in spite of these alarmist headlines.
Okay, we'll be hearing more about the economic situation as we go forward on our program. In the meantime, Rachel Donadio with the New York Times, Rome Bureau Chief of the New York Times, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Beppe Severnini is columnist for one of the papers in Italy. He's author of Mamma Mia, Berlusconi's Italy Explained for Posterity and Friends Abroad. Beppe Severnini, thank you very much for being on our program.
Well, thank you. NPR listeners are my friend. I've been on your programs a few times, so here I am.
All right. Well, we're glad to have you back and that you continue to be our friend. You have said at one point that if Mr. Berlusconi went to see a basketball game, he would walk out taller. What does that mean about the nature of this extraordinary international figure and national leader?
It means that the man has won three elections. It is true that he has control of the media, private television, and when he's in government, also public television, but it's a fact that he won three elections, I met Tony Blair today for a totally different reason. He won re-election as well. We're talking about like political superstar. And the problem of the Italian left, they always underestimated the man. You know, Berlusconi is a populist 2.0. He knows exactly who's talking to, and he always told us exactly what we wanted to hear, to the point of becoming us. I mean, the example you quoted from my book is, yes, of course. I mean, he does everything in order. You remember Zelig, you know, Woody Allen's film? He
sure.
does everything. He not only tells you you're right, and of course, if you are a woman from age 2 to 92, he's going to tell you that you're beautiful, but he's really, he could be very charming. And in fact, what brought him down is the economy, as Rachel correctly say, and the disaster in the bond market, and the fact that we now, that it was obvious that Italy couldn't go forward without three babysitters. Here, one in Washington, D.C., at the IMF, one in Frankfurt, at the European Central Bank, a German babysitter, perfect for us, and one in Belgium, you know, a Portuguese-French babysitter in Brussels. And if you realize that, he was, like, humiliated. So it's not going out well. And I think he knows that.
How has he managed, though, to last as long as he had, particularly given the sex scandal that he's recently gone through, having to face trial on charges of having paid for sex with a 17-year-old belly dancer?
Well, that's pretty serious stuff. And, of course, when he was surrounded by girls all the time and when asked, you know, are you faithful to your wife, his answer was frequently. Try that with your wife. I try with my wife. They don't like it. People laughed at some point. But then when he started to see really young girls, that's not the only one, people change their mind. People have daughters of that age. They don't want, you know, to think of a teenager daughter entertaining a man in his 70s, you know, late at night, and we'll stop here. So that kind of complicity became embarrassment. Embarrassment became shame, and shame is becoming anger. And that's why this sort of border crossing in relation with Berlusconi. And I wrote, and I was convinced that he was on his way out. But it's important to understand, for all democracies, that's why I was happy that the book came out in the United States, what populists can do. The man was very successful. He's been around for 18 years. That is a very long time. He's been longer than the two Bushes, you know, like more than twice as long than Reagan and blah, blah, blah. So the man is pretty strong, and he's an escape artist. We have a Houdini prime minister. The only point is that the new thing is that, you know, Houdini, there is a time when escape artist is stuck at the bottom of the pool with all his chains, and it's dramatic because you know that this time he won't make it. And this is a time for Berlusconi Houdini. He's stuck at the bottom of the pool. We don't want to be stuck with him there.
Well, was he so charming, such a chameleon over all of these years that Italians just didn't notice that they were running up all this debt, enormous debt? What is it, 120% of GDP? Is there any or has there been any significant or serious alternative to Berlusconi for all these years?
Well, first of all, debt, it's the sort of thing, even families, sometimes you start sort of piling up debt and one day you realize you are really in trouble, maybe even with your credit card in your country. We did that with public debt. Families are wealthy, but the Italian state was not. And if you're not into sort of public finance, it's not easy. And it all happened, you know, in the last few months. That's one thing. And you pointed out another very big problem. Did Berlusconi win three times or did the Italian left lost three times? The opposition is divided, is quarrelsome, and it's pretty annoying very often. They discuss all the time. And Berlusconi had an easy time. He's charming. He talks about women and politics, and television. He owns a soccer team. So there are people, especially sort of lower middle class Italians, who love the man. He's fun. And they don't want to know about details about politics. And the left is kind of seen as too serious. Now things have changed. Berlusconi's magic has gone. But, you know, it took a very long time.
What's going to happen when the Parliament, as we heard from Rachel Donadio, passes these austerity measures? Are people going to come into the streets as they did in Greece?
No, I don't think so. I may not be an expert in finance or politics, but I think I know my countrymen pretty well. I don't think so. I tell you why. I think Italians deep down know that we've lived probably above our means, that we have to do some sacrifices, even for young people, because it's a very bad deal for younger generation. You know, the baby boomers, we have them too. You know, I'm one of them, had a very cozy life. It's very tough for our children. We realize something needs to be done. Berlusconi was in no position, morally, politically, in terms of civic society leader, to ask for anything. He was like, had no moral authority apart from everything. But now Mario Monti is a good man, he's very respected. There'll be a very broad-based grand sort of gross, the German had gross coalition, grosse coalition, we have a grande coalizione. I think Italia will accept and even pay sort of a hefty wealth tax, and I have to prepare because lots of people are going to pay that. No, don't worry. We are very realistic. You know, only the Chinese are as realistic as we are. I mean, we know what we can do or we can't do.
Only the Chinese as realistic as the Italians. You have a wonderful sense of global characterizations.
And I've been to China last month. I spent just 2 weeks in the United States, and I have, you know, I see the difference, and I think it's. I was there every book talk. People would come to me and say, "Well, but we have Herman Cain," and I say, "Come on, he's an amateur." I mean, in America, a discussion about sexual innuendos about pizza toppings. Come on.
Beppe Severgnini, a columnist for Corriere della Sera, author of Mamma Mia, Berlusconi's Italy Explained for Posterity and Friends Abroad, a good friend himself of NPR. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Well, thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Just a couple of minutes before we go to our break, but first let me introduce Daniel Gross, who's director of the Center for European Policy Studies. That's a think tank in Brussels, and it's good to have you on our program.
Good evening to you.
We're talking about $2.6 trillion in debt here. What prospect does Italy have with the interest rates going above 7%, as we heard earlier, of actually paying it off?
These prospects are actually not too bad because not too long ago, Italy paid similar interest rates. It was immediately in the 1990s. It paid actually much higher interest rates above 10%. And the country was able to get its act together, find enough taxes, and pay off all of its creditors. So the problem is not so much that Italy couldn't pay if it wanted to. The question is whether the country still has the political strength and the social cohesion to find the money to pay off these interest rates and these creditors. And people are no longer so sure today.
So are you as optimistic as Beppe Severgnini?
I think that the Italian economy is actually not too bad. If you ask most economists and investors, they say, yes, we know, Italy is a huge debt, but it's mostly owed to Italians. Italians have a nice saving rate. The Italians have lots of money abroad. So in principle, there shouldn't be a problem.
Daniel Gross at the Center for European Policy Studies. We'll be back and continue this conversation after we take a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook later on, presidential candidate Rick Perry's latest gaffe. Can his campaign survive? We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, we're only back with To the Point, talking today about contagion in the Eurozone. The tension has now shifted from Greece, a tiny country, by comparison to Italy, which has 17% of the Eurozone and a debt of 120% of GDP. We're talking now with Daniel Gross at the Center for European Policy Studies, who says the economy in Italy is okay, but the problem has been one of governance. Are you then, Daniel Gross, glad to see the end as a political figure of Mr. Berlusconi, if in fact he really does resign on Monday?
Berlusconi will resign, but the question is, will Italy change? Will Italy change back, and can Italy repair all the damage he has done? Because the true damage he has done is that he has undermined the foundations of democracy. He has undermined the sense of the rule of law. He has undermined the quality of the public administration, of the control of corruption. All these indicators, Italy has really fallen back and is now behind Greece. And that is not something that can be changed by a new technocratic government. That's the Italians, the opposition, the social partners. Everybody has to change, and that will take years at end.
We heard earlier that the left has not provided any serious alternative to Berlusconi. Why wouldn't a technological kind of government, a technocracy, if you will, provide what Italy needs in the meantime?
A technocratic government is useful for a couple of months. They pass the laws that Europe wants. But to clean up an administration is a task for a generation. You can't take 15 technocrats and clean up an administration which has millions of components, hundreds of thousands of different organizations, tens of thousands of different positions which have to be filled and have been filled by people who are not competent. That is a very tough task which requires deep political support and a very long time.
Is there a cultural issue with not just Italy and Greece, but also Portugal that is involved in and is creating these economic problems?
I don't think so. If you look at Italy 10 years ago, Italy actually had a surplus in its external account, so it was saving enough. Its economy wasn't at that point doing too badly. So I think if cultures change over 10 years, then hopefully they can be changed back. It's not something so deep-seated that it cannot be repaired, but it's not a repair that you can do overnight. It takes perhaps the same amount of time it took for Italy to deteriorate to come back, and the same goes, of course, for Portugal as well.
The northern countries in the EU, particularly Germany, which is the one that has the most resources, seem to be very dubious about the southern countries, including Italy, on a cultural basis. They say, why should we be the ones who live according to our means and have to bail out people who, as you describe, are undemocratic and not paying attention to the rule of law and highly corrupt? Is that a widespread feeling, and does it suggest that there's not going to be much sympathy for Italy if, in fact, this new government can't do its job?
Exactly. That's the key problem, because the financial markets perceive that Italy perhaps has a chance to pull through, but they ask themselves, if we don't give Italy money today, tomorrow it might be illiquid and therefore insolvent. Is there anybody else who might help Italy to tide over for a couple of months or a couple of years? And in principle, this should be done by the European Central Bank and by the German government. But both of these institutions are saying, Italy, we are not so sure. And because everybody hesitates to help the country, you see the bond market sell off, which then itself drives Italy further down into the abyss.
In the meantime, the bond yield for government bonds was 7.4 yesterday, as Rachel Donadio said. She says that's not sustainable. Who holds the bonds?
The bonds are held to a large extent actually by Italians themselves, and they haven't sold. But they have been bought to a large extent by German and other banks and insurance companies. And what's going on there is actually quite preoccupying, because the German regulators are telling their own banks, Italy, we think is a risk. Please sell. If you sell at a loss, even you think you might get the money in the end, please sell today. And of course, if everybody tries to sell, the price just goes rock bottom. And that is what why we have this sell-off, and why you have an acute financial crisis. If everybody waited, then Italy would be just fine and probably could pay off its debt over time.
What about Spain? What about France?
Spain actually has economic numbers which are mostly much worse than Italy's. Foreign debt of Spain is much larger. The excesses in the banking system are vastly greater. Had a huge real estate bubble, bigger than that of Florida or California. And therefore, Spain, in theory, should be much more exposed than Italy. But Spain has a more cohesive government, and therefore financial market trusts that it will get grips of its own problems, which are actually larger than those of Italy.
And France?
And France is, on the pure numbers, not very far from the situation of Italy. But everybody knows or believes that the Germans will stand by France and whatever happens, and that is why nobody will sell off really France, although a little bit has already happened. Even France is now paying a very large risk premium relative to Germany, but of course not to the same scale as Italy or Spain.
What about China? What about Brazil, even? The United States Congress has said no way is the U.S. going to help out the European countries. But what about those other sources of potential assistance?
But they are not needed. We have in Europe a balanced current account. Unlike the United States, there's enough savings in Europe to pay for all our deficits. But the problem is the Germans, who continue to save, are now completely unwilling to find anybody south of the Alps, and they're actually forced to by that by their own regulators. So there's too much savings which is bottled up in the euro area, and if we just get in Europe our own act together and distribute these savings, then we could deal with our problem. So there's no need for additional capital from abroad, and that's why, quite rightly, the Chinese are saying, why should we put money into the southern European periphery when the Germans, who are sitting much closer, are refusing to do so?
Daniel Gross, again, director of the Center for European Policy Studies, a think tank in Brussels. Greg Ipp is U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. He's author of The Little Book of Economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World. Greg Ipp, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me back, Warren.
What does all of this mean for the United States? And to what extent do American banks own Italian bonds that might go sour?
Well, the United States feels a little bit like a helpless spectator watching this unfold in Europe. There isn't a lot that Americans or American policymakers can do to motivate European policymakers to solve this problem beyond urging them on to say, you know, you have to act forcefully to contain this crisis. The consequences for the American economy are a little bit complex. The United States does sell stuff to Europe and to Italy, but not very much. Italy accounts for only about 1% of American exports. Europe as a whole is only about 18%. In fact, Mexico, Canada, even China are as important, if not more important, than Europe as a whole. So why does it matter? Well, it matters not because of the trade linkages, but because of the financial linkages. How big are those? Well, again, American banks have very little direct exposure to Greece and even Italy. They have about $46 billion of direct exposure to Italy on their books. And of that, only about $13 billion is to the Italian government. The rest is mostly to banks and Italian companies. Now, here's the problem, though. Most of European banks, especially French banks, have enormous exposure to Italy, and American banks have enormous exposure to France. So if Italy were in some scenario to default on its debts, that would cause enormous problems for French banks. Many of them would be thrown into crisis mode, would require bailouts, or they would collapse. And if French banks collapse, then that would have huge ripple effects into the United States because American banks have so much exposure to French banks and to German banks and to European banks as a whole. So, and not only that, but French banks have significant operations throughout the United States, and they would be sort of thrown into chaos as well. And then there's the overall effect on confidence. We've seen repeatedly in the last couple of years that when panic erupted in Europe, it happened early in 2010 when Greece's problems first came to the fore, it sent American stock markets into a tailspin and really rattled the nerves and the confidence of American households and business, and they just basically stopped doing anything like investing and hiring, and the economy briefly ground to a halt. If the Italian situation got a lot worse and led to some of these sort of like dark scenarios of a default or an exit from the euro, it would almost be impossible for the United States to escape the effects.
What's the nature of the exposure of American banks to France? Is it credit default swaps?
It is mostly, well, the direct exposure, by which I mean how much they've simply lent to European companies, to European banks, to European governments in the form of owning their bonds, it's around $270 billion, of which the vast majority is money that they have lent to French banks. And a lot of this is in the form of overnight loans, it's in the form of, like, owning their short-term paper, it might be in the form of owning outright subsidiaries in France. There are credit default swaps. These are often used as insurance. In other words, if an American bank has lent money to a French bank but worries that the French bank may not pay it back, it can go out and buy an insurance policy so that in the event that it doesn't get its money back, the insurance policy will cover its losses. These are called credit default swaps. So that will, in some sense, offset some of that exposure. On the other hand, American companies are also selling that insurance, and so they would be on the hook if that insurance were called in. However, there have been some problems that have cropped up recently. A few weeks ago, European leaders arranged for international banks to write down a lot of what Greece owed them, but they did so under this unusual provision that said that they would therefore not also trigger the insurance provision and all the credit default swaps that they had purchased. This seemed like a good idea at the time to the Europeans, but what it's done is it's made everybody else wonder, well, what in the world is the worth of this insurance that we've been buying if policymakers are simply going to annul it later on? So we have extra uncertainty in, built into the system.
Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. Let me go back to Daniel Gross at the Center for European Policy Studies. What's the future, do you think, of the Eurozone? Is it going to look different in a relatively short time from the way it looks now? Will Greece be forced out, for example? Will there be other kinds of changes forced perhaps by Germany and people who are so resentful of everybody south of the Alps?
It will certainly be different because it can't continue the way it's going now. Most people guess that Greece will not make it, will have to leave the Eurozone, probably in a rather messy way. But it's still most likely that Italy will stay in, but it will require help in an unorthodox way. And that means that the nature of the monetary union will change. When the Germans said yes to the euro, they thought, okay, we have the same money, but we have an independent central bank, and we will never have to support the others. Now they know that they do have to, and that's why they want to have also new structures where they can basically supervise what the others are doing, and that will require new structures which will change the face of the monetary union.
So, Greg Ipp, as face changes, will the markets in the United States lose confidence in Europe?
Well, it's very complicated because the question becomes, what is Europe? So an interesting question is, if people are starting to price in the risk of an exit from, like the Eurozone falling apart, why is it that the euro as a currency has not fallen more against the dollar? Well, presumably all the money that is now denominated in euros will then be denominated in something else. And people might be willing to hold, for example, euros that get converted back into German Deutschmarks, but less willing to hold euros that are, you know, converted back into Italian lira or Greek drachmas. So it's a very complicated situation that people will have to sort out. There are, you know, anecdotes abounding now of lawyers getting phone calls from companies and banks wondering, well, what does it mean? I have all these contracts written in euros. What does it mean if they are converted back to old currencies and so on? The prospect of the Eurozone falling apart is just raises so many unanswered questions and so much chaos that I think the baseline assumption of most businesses and investors is that it's just so dreadful that it can't be allowed to happen. That doesn't mean they can see a way out of this mess, but they're just sort of crossing their fingers and hoping it doesn't happen.
What about the debt of the United States, or the deficit that the Super Committee of Congress is now supposed to be dealing with? In what ways is the situation economically in the United States similar to what we're seeing in some of the countries of Europe?
Well, here's the irony is that, in fact, on most metrics, the United States fiscal situation is way worse than that of Europe as a whole. Let's look at Italy. Their budget deficit this year will probably be around 4% of GDP. The United States, maybe 10%. And on current plans, Italy's deficit is shrinking quite a bit more than that of the United States. It is true that the Italian debt overall is quite large, but it's also relatively stable. It has not been growing the way that of the United States has. Same story in Spain. Spain's debt and deficits are both quite a bit lower than those of the United States. So why is it that Spain and Italy are being forced to pay 5 to 7% to borrow, and the United States is only being forced to pay 2%? It's because the people who lend money to the United States, if you buy a 10-year Treasury bond from the United States, you're completely certain that 10 years from now you'll get back 100 cents on the dollar. People used to feel the same way when they bought a Spanish or an Italian bond, but they don't believe that any longer. They now think of the bond of Spain and Italy not as a risk-free government bond, as maybe something like a risky corporate bond. And they now have to do something they have never had to do before, and that's price in the possibility that one of these countries will default and will not pay back 100 cents on the dollar. Will the United States end up in that position at some point? Well, it's been an unusual period for the last few years, so you should never say never. But the fact is that countries that control their own currencies, as the United States does, as Great Britain does, seldom run into these problems. They might have an inflation problem later on. They might have rising interest rates as they have to sort of like pay more and more to attract borrowers. But you do not tend to get these sort of like sudden losses of confidence that the Greeks and the Italians are suffering right now.
So, Daniel Gross, big question with not much time to answer it, but that's true, I guess, of all the questions we ask on the radio. But was the Eurozone, and particularly the euro, a mistake in the first place?
With hindsight, it was a mistake to take in too many countries. Certainly, Greece was a shaky candidate from the beginning, and they really didn't have the numbers. And it was a mistake not to supervise this economy much more closely from the very beginning. If that had been done, most of the problems we are seeing today would have been avoided.
What about what Greg Ipp just described as something too dreadful to contemplate here in the United States, and that is that the Eurozone could split up? Do you think that'll happen?
Very unlikely, but unfortunately no longer it can no longer be excluded, because the way the policymakers stumble from mistake to mistake, it might happen, although they don't want it, just because financial markets force them into a corner out of which they cannot escape anymore. So I would say it's probably we can avoid it, but we have to keep our fingers crossed that policymakers in Italy and Greece keep their nerves and keep their country together, and that at the European level also they make clear that they will help countries which are unjustifiedly attacked by speculative investors.
So, Greg Ipp, the markets went down here in this country yesterday. Today they seem to be going up.
Yeah, American investors are dealing with cross-cutting tensions. On the one hand, there's all the concern about what happens to Italy and the shock to confidence that might entail. But then they look at things happening in the United States and they actually see some positive things happening. This morning, the Labor Department reported that the number of people claiming unemployment insurance has going down, which suggests that the labor market is actually steadily improving. You know, notwithstanding all the trouble in the world, American exports did surprisingly well in the month of September. And so there are reasons to suspect that the American economy is doing remarkably well, given the tensions that you see in Europe. People are certainly worried that the so-called super committee of Congress is going to hit an impasse and will not come up with a very satisfactory solutions to our to the debt and deficit problems. But compared to what they're dealing with in Europe, these seem like rather small marginal problems. I do worry, however, that there's a little bit of delusion going on here. Investors just do not seem to have taken on board how serious the shock to confidence would be of the events that are unfolding in Europe.
Okay, that's all the time we have for this segment of our program, but I want to thank you both. Greg Ipp, U.S. Economics Editor for The Economist magazine, author of The Little Book of Economics, How the Economy Works in the Real World, and Daniel Gross, Director of the Center for European Policy Studies, a think tank in Brussels. Good to have both of you on our program. Once again, thanks a lot for being here today. During debates with other Republican presidential candidates, Texas Governor Rick Perry has been plagued by verbal gaffes and other kinds of mistakes. Last night in Michigan, it got worse than ever. Back in a moment with To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. During last night's debate in Michigan, Governor Perry said that as president, he would eliminate three federal departments. Here's what happened next.
It's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five. Yeah, okay. So five. Commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's stop deposition.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about? Or?
No, sir. No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's
you
no doubt about
but
that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one I can't. Sorry. Oops.
That's how it went. Today, Perry made the rounds of the morning talk shows on Good Morning America. Here's his response to George Stephanopoulos, telling him that the GOP operatives are saying he's finished and asking how he's going to recover.
Well, the bottom line is that we're going to get up every day and go talk to the American people. And they know that there's not a perfect candidate that's been made yet. And I'm kind of proof positive of it every day that people make mistakes when they debate. People make mistakes when they make statements.
Larry Sabato is director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. His books include the upcoming The Kennedy Half Century. Good to have you back on our program.
Thanks so much.
Interesting that your book should be about John Kennedy, because you've been watching debates, presidential debates, since the first ones between Kennedy and Richard Nixon.
Yes, indeed. And it's been quite a story, high points and low points, and last night was a low point.
How does it compare to other debates that you've been watching over the years?
Well, this is going to make the all-time reel of bloopers for the debates. There's no question about it. And look, it was cringe-inducing. I've talked to a wide variety of people today, and regardless of their preference for candidates and parties, everyone felt badly for Perry. I mean, it was hard to watch. He simply wasn't able to come up with that third agency. It went on forever. And it's damaged him, not so much because of that one moment. If this had been an exception to a series of boffo performances or even adequate ones in debates, he would have been fine. But as we all know, he's had a problem in every single debate. This is the worst moment, but it's of a piece with all the other moments.
Mark McKinnon was the media consultant to George W. Bush. He is saying today that Governor Perry is now a dead man walking. Is that too strong?
Well, in our politics, we seem to have a lot of Lazaruses that they can come back to life. I mean, we all remember Nixon, for example. I mean, written off, and ABC had a program about him in 1962 after he lost the California governorship entitled The Obituary, the political obituary of Richard M. Nixon. And 6 years later, he was president. So you never write anybody off who's got the presidential bug until they're 6 feet under. However, I would say, given everything that's happened to him, the fact that he had such a buildup and he shot to the top and he became the front runner, and now he is in single digits in some polls nationally at the 4% level, it's going to be extremely difficult to come back.
Now, the Perry campaign is offering money to anybody who can suggest an agency of the federal government they want to eliminate, and he's going to go himself on the David Letterman show tonight. Can he laugh this off?
No. I think people will laugh with him and enjoy doing so because they really didn't enjoy laughing at him. No one wants to see someone suffer like that in a public debate. It was just horribly embarrassing. And you know it's inevitable that he will simply skip over some of those top 10, or, you know, he'll not be able to read them or whatever. They're going to make the joke. But it's an apology tour. That's what it is, whether he's joking about it or whether he's saying, I regret it, it's still an apology tour. He's apologizing for something, and his whole campaign so far has been an apology tour.
He's going to be in another debate with the, says he will anyway, before the Iowa caucuses. Do you think that what happened last night will drive up the ratings?
Probably. You know, people do like to see car crashes. Not that that will happen, but people may tune in to see whether there is another car crash. Here's the truth. Rick Perry is terrible at debates. His own people privately admit that. That's why he avoided them for years in Texas. He only had two or three debates in all those campaigns for governor. He's not going to turn into Cicero before Saturday night when he debates again.
But the presidency of the United States doesn't require Cicero necessarily. Why are the debates all that important?
I think people look for those spontaneous moments, and they got one last night when candidates go off script, when they forget the lines their consultants and staffers have written for them, when maybe they're asked something they weren't expecting to hear, and you actually get a glimpse of the real person. We don't see the real people anymore. They're manufactured. They're all plastic, Democratic and Republican alike to a certain extent.
On the other hand, what the Perry people are saying and what Rick Perry is suggesting in the way he's behaving is that this humanizes him as a candidate. He's not one of those plastic guys after all. He's a real guy.
Rick Perry was all too human before last night. I don't think it was necessary to have him choke on a question.
Herman Cain's campaign has been raising additional money in the aftermath of the, not the aftermath, but as he's been accused of inappropriate sexual behavior. Does Perry have the kind of support, do you think, that might lead to him actually getting more money?
Well, he has support Cain doesn't have, which is Perry's governor of a big, rich state of Texas. He's the incumbent governor, and there are a lot of people down there who have to give. They don't really have a choice about it. So I suspect that some of that additional money will be coming in. But, you know, as I've said many times today, money can't always buy you love, and this is really one of those circumstances. By the way, Herman Cain has to count his stars lucky, given the fact that he was going to be the focus. of the negative coverage coming out of that debate. And he got a pass because Rick Perry self-destructed. Kane didn't have to come to terms as much as he had expected with the sexual harassment charges. So he's very happy to pass the baton of criticism to Rick Perry.
Anybody else that benefited from this? Any of the other candidates?
Oh, I thought Romney did fine. Gingrich did fine. The other candidates seem barely present somehow. I suppose it's because they're not doing well in the polls, and so you don't pay as close attention to them. Everyone talks about who's going to end up being the Annie Romney. You know, the new hot nominee is Newt Gingrich. They've all had a turn at it. You know, it was going to be Perry, and it was going to be Bachman, and it was going to be this one, it was going to be that one. Now it's Gingrich. But I think many Republicans, while they don't particularly care for Romney and they have problems with him because of his flip-flopping and lack of strong belief in their view, they're coming to terms with the fact that he seems to be the most fluent, the most articulate, the most prepared. He turns in consistently good performances at debates and also on the stump.
Okay. Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, author of the upcoming The Kennedy Half Century. As always, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much.
Program produced today by Sonia Geis with Caitlin Schamberg and Katie Cooper, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can email us, share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/To The Point. Join the conversation on To The Point's Facebook page. We'll be back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.